Hello and welcome to Blogosphere, Serious Influence, the podcast all about the business side of the influencer industry. I'm Alice Audley and I'm the founder of Blogosphere. We run events, a magazine, an influencer network, and now a podcast too, which I'll be presenting. If there are any questions about the influencer industry that you want answered, please do drop me an email at alice@blogosphere.com. We're delighted to announce that Series 3 of Serious Influence has an exclusive sponsor, the music licensing platform, Licked. Licked provide commercial music from real labels for licensing into creators' content. It means that you can have great music on your videos without the fear of copyright claims or losing ad revenue. If you want to learn more about how you can legally use the music you love, be sure to check out Licked's website, licked.co. That's L-I-C-K-D.co. Today on Blogosphere Serious Influence, I'm joined by Matt Coyne, who is known online as Man vs. Baby. Matt went viral on Facebook in 2015 with a post all about his newborn son. The post was the first of many, and he is now a best-selling author, has a following of more than 250,000, and was also Blogosphere's Parenting Influencer of the Year 2019.
My name is Matt Coyne. I'm the creator of something called Man vs. Baby, which is a blog and social media thing about me and my little boy, Charlie. I'm also the author of two books based on the blog, one called Dummy and one called Man vs. Toddler, which are available at all good retail outlets.
Excellent plug early on. So tell us a bit more about your background. I want to go all the way back. So education, university, and first sort of job.
Right. Well, I wanted to be a journalist, actually. That's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a writer. But my careers teacher had different ideas. When I told him that I wanted to do, like, journalism A-levels and stuff like that from school, he said, well, I wanted to be fucking Burt Reynolds. And then handed me an application to fix gas cookers, to do an apprenticeship doing that.
How did that actually impact you?
Well, it meant that I didn't go on to college for a while. So I did a succession of terrible, terrible jobs. So I've like packed toilet rolls for a living. In fact, that's one of the worst jobs I ever did because I got the sack from packing toilet rolls and then was offered the job back to clean the machine that had replaced me to pack the toilet rolls. That's about as low as it gets.
But having wanted to go into journalism, did you, during that time, kind of obviously wasn't the most creative of roles, so did you have an outlet, like, were you writing on the side back then? Did you pitch articles, freelance?
No, I didn't do anything at all. I didn't really write until I then went to university a couple of years later, so I went to Manchester Uni to do English there.
How did that go?
2-2. Okay. So it's all right, yeah. I wasn't enthused by it and stuff like. And my dissertation was on French feminism in Frankenstein.
Okay.
You can still probably get hold of a copy if you're desperate. But so I wasn't really, I wasn't excited about it or enthused by it. And then I didn't write anything for 20 years, probably, like 15, 20 years, until this came along. And
yeah.
The original Facebook post that kicked all this off was the longest thing I'd written in probably 15 years.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, we will go on to that. I just want to know what type of kind of personality you had. Did you work hard because you weren't enthused by it? And there's this 20-year period before you found your passion. So
what
was life like during that?
Put it this way, the job that I do now, as in writing, is the only job I've ever enjoyed or liked. Every job to me was just a way of getting money, pay your rent, and then hopefully leave it at the door at 5 o'clock. I just couldn't be arsed with it. I just really didn't want to do it. and if you can't find something that you are enthused about, that makes your work days longer and your work weeks longer. So I'm glad I've found what I do now, and I'm glad I've found an awful lot of people who are enthused by what they do as well. It's quite energised and it's quite good for creativity to surround yourself with people like that. I think it's a lot better than packing toilet rolls, I'll tell you that.
So what was the first social platform that you found? I know that you went viral on Facebook. You were a member of there before. Had you followed any YouTubers? Were you aware of the rise of influencers? Did you follow anyone? There's a lot of questions for you.
I was absolutely clueless about social media, really. I was very late to Facebook, even personally. It wasn't part of my world, really. And it was only through my initial Facebook post that I then found this entire community that existed that I wasn't aware of. It's very easy once you're in that community to think that everybody knows everything about what's going on, and you mention people, and sometimes, you know, you'll go to an event and you get a question about, for example, the things that have happened in the past couple of weeks in our parenting community. And you'll get an awful lot of people sat there with blank faces because they've never heard of these people. I mean, it's easy to forget that it is quite an enclosed community until you go into it, especially parenting, because obviously not being a parent, there's no reason why you would know that I exist or that Harafa Jinnah exists or Mumsy Mum, because if you're not a parent, there's no reason to be in that world, isn't
it? Do you think that if you are a parent and you want to get into the parenting blogging community, that it is a friendly and welcoming community? Or do you think that there are barriers to entry? And what is your advice?
I think it's a really friendly community. And it's dead. I found it was, anyway. I assumed when I finished the first book that I was in competition with these people who, the other people who had books out, and assumed that I'd get no support from them or whatever, and they're completely the opposite, incredibly supportive, especially when you get to that stage. But they're, you know, everybody sort of helps each other out, really. And that's when you're starting out, and when you grow it, I think it's pretty good like that. And I mean, maybe that's not everybody's experience. I can appreciate that starting out now is a lot harder for all kinds of reasons. Maybe it can seem a little bit enclosed when it's like that, as though people are pulling up the ladder after them. I sometimes see that with some parenting bloggers.
Do you think that's maybe because since you've been around that it's now much more commercialised, so the bridges are being drawn up because it's actually a competition in terms of landing branded campaigns? Do you think money?
I mean, maybe that's part of it. Once you chuck money into the mix, everything gets a bit more muddy, doesn't it? I go to some of these blogging conferences or whatever, and I've spoken at a couple whereby I've been on a panel with somebody else who's suggesting that bloggers do certain things or don't do certain things. You know, like follow for follow stuff, in particularly Instagram was big at one point. And I've got somebody sat at the side of me saying, you must never do that, and it's terrible. And I'm knowing full well that they've been doing it for, you know, for the past 5 years and grown a decent following. That's no skin off my nose whether they do that or they don't. But I think it's a bit mean to turn around to people who are just starting out and suggest things that, you know, that things are bad when that's how they built their entire brand. You know,
yeah,
what I mean?
But a bit sort of duplicitous. Let's go back to this first Facebook post, because unlike many bloggers, you literally went viral with your first post. What year was that, and what was the post about?
That was 2015. Thing. I'm trying to remember because it was when my little boy was born, so I should know the year. But yeah, 2015, it was basically about my little boy Charlie. He was about 3 months old at the time, and I was sat in a shopping centre. What I wanted to do was tell everybody in my family how I was getting on in those first 3 months, sort of to avoid them coming around our house, because, you know, you just don't want people coming around your house, do you? So I wrote this quite, it turned into quite a long post. It was like 2,000 words by the time I'd finished it. And I put that on Facebook just for my family. And what happened is, I woke up, I didn't really think anything about it. And then the following morning, it got like 20 likes. And I was like, bloody hell, I've nailed parenting here, because nobody listens to a word I say ordinarily. So 20 likes was quite a big deal at the time. And so people started to screenshot that post, because I'd not set it to global. You know how you can set it to show it to everybody? It was just shown to my family and friends. But people started screenshotting and sharing it with outside of that, those people. And then I started getting messages asking me if I could turn it to global. So I did that. And then by the end of the day, it got like 10,000 likes. And then it just grew and grew over the next few weeks. So that original post has been seen by 25 million people now. That, you know, it's insane. Because that kind of blew up, journalists can be quite lazy about a virus, so it's quite an easy thing to do a story on. So you just pick it up, you pick up the text, you cut and paste it in, you get the person's name wrong who wrote it, get their age wrong, and then just post it online, and it's another bit of content. So that happened, and it snowballed, and then over the next couple of weeks I was on like telly and radio and stuff. And because of that, a couple of agents got in touch and asked me if I thought about writing a book. So I thought, yeah, I did, like 20-odd years ago, like, I mean, before before life ground me into the dust. So I'd had all these meetings in London, and they all said basically the same thing: you need to write 30,000 words, you need to prove you can do it, and we'll then cart that content around publishers and see if anybody's interested. So that's what I did.
After that post, did you start your own blog, or did you set up a Facebook page? Because I suppose that original one was on your personal.
Once we'd finally got a book deal based on that text, it was my agent who said, you need to start a blog. Because all of a sudden you've got to write 100,000 words rather than what I'd been writing over the past 20 years, which is like text messages and stuff like that. And he says, you best to have a bit of practice and start up this blog. And he said, start that and we'll see how we get on. And he suggested The Hapless Dad. That's a fucking terrible name. I thought that's a terrible idea.
You probably wouldn't be allowed to do that now with the new guidelines that have come in. I think the Advertising Standards Authority took away that. Is it like, don't want to be actually on the record. Some yogurt brand didn't
right, have
something
okay.
recently. Yeah, and it was like Hapless Dads, and it's that stereotype of
is it?
Parent. You're not allowed to advertise
right,
that anymore.
Another good job that I didn't use that name then. But I went with Man vs. Baby, and I set up a Facebook page originally, and I just assumed that everybody who liked that original post would all just arrive over at this other Facebook page, and it was just like nobody. It was like crickets. It was like me, my mum, my auntie Pat. It was one of those where we were just emailing around everybody saying, follow me Facebook page, it'd be great. So there was nothing. And then I wrote another post. It was about taking Charlie on his first holiday when he was about 5 months old, and that one blew up again, and that's what really kickstarted.
And that one was on your page?
Yeah, that was on Man vs. Baby, so that's the one that then kicked it on. And then by resharing the original post then on the Man vs. Baby page, that brought a whole new audience to that, and then that blew up again. So it was two or three posts that managed to get it going. It wasn't quite that. Like, the first one was great in terms of it got the book deal, but it was the subsequent post that then grew Man vs. Baby and turned it into what it is, which is a community, really. I mean, I post something, and I try to make it interesting, try to make it funny or whatever. I prefer the comments, really. I can lose myself in the comments of it because people just talk to each other. It becomes more like a forum and more like a community. Right? Mm. So.
In terms of the social platforms that you're on, you update Instagram a lot, very entertaining over there. Facebook's where you've got your biggest audience, is that right? Like 250,000?
Yeah. And
how many have you got on Facebook? It's
250,000? 250,000, yeah.
How does that feel, like a quarter of a million people?
It's quite weird. We could, if we all got in together in the same place, we could invade somewhere,
yeah.
Which would be, nowhere good, Isle of Wight or somewhere, you know what I mean? But still, it's quite a lot of people. It's quite strange. There's a point at which it gets to that it's difficult to imagine as actual people in real life. But then you do events, and you do book events in particular, and, you realise that they do exist, and you put names to faces, and it's amazing how you recognise names and recognise faces, that even though there's so many different names, it's amazing the ones that stick and the ones that do form part of that community and become like little nodes to Man vs. Baby, really.
What is your favourite platform of the ones you're on, and why, and which is the one that you would give up if you had to, and why?
I'm relatively new to Instagram, so I've only been on it a couple of years, so I kind of built Facebook and then thought, I'll try and... Because the advice I received initially was choose one platform and stick to it. And I sort of did that originally. And then as they slowly changed the way that Facebook worked and changed the algorithm, it spoiled it for me a little bit. Because what I always used to do was telling stories over a series of days. I would say something one day, there'd be a response to it, and then I'd be able to respond to that. And over a period of 2 weeks, you'd have quite a nice narrative, and I loved that about it. And then, of course, when they started not showing everything to everybody and the things fall out of sync and people see the first post and not the third one, it all gets a bit messy and confusing. And I quite like that about Instagram now, the way you can do that with stories. You can build a story over 24 hours, which is quite good. I think I'd probably give up Twitter.
Really?
Yeah, just because... It can be a little bit more toxic, I think. I find myself being a lot more caustic on Twitter. I don't know whether that's because of the environment or whether the responses that I get on Twitter are a little bit more caustic themselves, but I tend to be a bit more aggressive on Twitter for some reason.
I suppose it's the character limit, that there's only so much in response. It feels like quite a defensive place when you get to a bigger level, because I think there is a sweet spot when you're sort of relatively... small, where people are actually just nice and you can build a really friendly, nice community.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think I think what you say about the character limit is absolutely true. I'll never use like 5 words when I can use 5,000. And that was the thing about the original poster or any other post I've done since. I bang on, you know what I mean? I like to write, you know what I mean? And anything that limits that is annoying. I find the character limit on Instagram annoying. That gets on my nerves. So obviously Twitter's considerably less than that. You know what I mean? So.
Well, we touched a little bit that Twitter can be toxic. Now, trolling, you have quite a... I think it was on your Instagram or Facebook, there was a quote of it, and someone had trolled you, and then you said to them that, oh, you've been selected to win a gift voucher worth something, and then they... What happened there?
Yeah, I can't remember what he was giving me grief about now. It was... I remember him saying I wasn't funny or something like. It was kind of a nasty one. The entire back and forth is not in that screenshot. It goes back a little bit further. Like he'd been messaging me for quite a few months. What I did is I sent him a message back as though it was from admin, which basically saying that everybody who messages or contributes to Man vs. Baby is entered into a draw to win 175 quid worth of vouchers, and that whether it's good or bad, he'd won it that month. And he messaged back saying, basically said, admin, is this real? And just thought, no, of course it's not fucking real. Suck a bag of dicks. So he was he wasn't happy about that. I get quite a lot of content from trolls. I quite like it. I'm quite sadistic about that. I like people giving me grief. But I'm quite clever about it as well. I only reply to the idiots. It needs to be make me look good, otherwise I don't reply to them. But I get in trouble with it as well, because I did. There's quite an important point when your publisher takes your first draft books out to the major retailers. So they have these big meetings where it's all the supermarkets are sat around a table and stuff, and they pitch the book. I'd replied to a troll the day before. It's the only thing I've ever deleted in terms of trolls, and it was this guy who'd again said that I wasn't funny. Said that I wasn't fit to own a dog, let alone a kid and all this sort of stuff. I took his profile photo and I photoshopped it. So one of his arms was a penis and the other one was a lobster claw. And I sent him back saying, that's quite funny. He went apeshit. He went absolutely apeshit. The point being, my editor is stood in this meeting with like Tesco and Asda and all these bigwigs, and he's got a 12-foot screen behind him, showing them my social media thing, and he's showing him these are Matt's numbers for social media, and he says, and just scrolled up, and there was this 12-foot cock and balls on the screen. It's like, yeah, he just came out of the meeting and just sent me a message saying no, and delete that now. So it's the only time they've ever censored me, but I think justifiably so on that occasion.
Do you think that we're seeing more people censor themselves because of brand safety or appearing brand safe? And do you think that that doesn't really help authenticity?
I think it's definitely true. It definitely doesn't help authenticity. But I also think it's worse than that. It makes it boring. And that's far worse than not being authentic, because why would any brand want to work with anybody who's boring? People definitely censor themselves, because I get that advice all the time. So if I'll go to an event, someone will sidle up to me at some point and say, listen, your following could grow a lot more if you didn't, for example, swear, you know, or didn't necessarily touch on certain subjects. That makes you necessarily toxic to certain brands. But what are you going to do? Just not be authentic, not be decent, you know. At the end of the day, you wouldn't have got to the stage that you've got without being at least yourself. So I find it quite depressing the way that interesting accounts become less interesting as the ads come in. I'm not so bothered about seeing ads every third, fourth post. That doesn't bother me. I'm either interested in it, I'll scroll by, whatever. I'm much more bothered about those posts being boring and the things that are in between being boring, just because it makes you beige enough to appeal to a, you know, to, I'm not going to name a brand because I might want to work with, but you know what I mean. Yeah.
Do you think that Instagram removing likes will actually help creativity, because people get stuck into the rut of the algorithm and what's rewarded and very much what those likes are, and actually now that they're not going to be shown, people might spice up their content a bit?
I certainly don't think it's the nuclear bomb that everybody's thinking it is. You know, there's that many people panicking. Everybody's got dead obsessed with likes and followers. I don't really doesn't really make that much difference to me. I mean, I can understand why when people want to demonstrate viability to a brand and they want to be able to say, look, this is how many likes it's got, and do that in a shorthand way that the brands can just look at your profile and in literally 5 seconds see that each one of your posts gets X number of likes, therefore you must have a certain amount of reach. So I understand that, but it's not. I don't think that means it's necessarily going away. I don't think brands are daft. I don't necessarily think they work in the best ways sometimes. I think sometimes they forget that the people that they're wanting to engage in using ads and collaborate with, I sometimes think they forget that those people are quite creative in and of themselves. So they basically foist on, this is the idea, share it on your things. They're trying to access the followers rather than access the creativity of the person who's doing it. I'm not talking about me in particular, but I'm talking about quite a lot of people that, you know, they'd be quite creative for every other post and it'd be quite interesting. And then an ad drops in like, and it stands out like a sore thumb that it's been written by PR. And that's a shame, I think.
We want to use your creativity, but with our words, and then it just jars.
Just kills it a little bit, really.
We touched upon brand safety there and sort of trolling. The parenting community, blogging community, has had a rough couple of weeks. Do you think, to say the least, do you think that that is going to have wider ramifications? And what are your sort of thoughts on that?
I mean, probably.
For those who don't know, just Google it, but we won't be saying it live on the podcast, but yeah.
Yeah, Google it. It's a rabbit hole. You'll be at it for quite a while. I mean, sort of inevitably, again, without going into too much detail about it, especially if it's certain accounts that are built on an authenticity and built on certain themes of sisterhood or liberalism or whatever, if that's either revealed or shown not to be as authentic as it might have pertained to be, then brands aren't going to touch that with a barge pole, are they? And if that can be shown of one of the bigger accounts, then presumably the people will be looking to see whether that's true across other accounts and whether it's something that's more pervasive than that's one account or those two accounts. So it's bound to affect it in some way, I'd have thought. But.
Well, maybe it will encourage brands to look outside and pick different kind of parenting people to work with. Safe isn't brand safe, then...
Yeah, I think brand safe doesn't necessarily mean brand safe. I think authenticity means brand safe, because basically what you're doing is you know what you're going to get with that. If someone wanted to work with me, I'm not going to change the way that I post. You look at any ad of mine, and there's not many of them, but if you look at them, they are in keeping. I write them, and I won't steer away from that. And if at the end of it they're offended by what I've done, then just don't pay me. I mean, I'm not precious about it. I just think you know what you get. So sometimes brand safe doesn't mean brand safe, does it? But then again, brand safe is lucrative. That projection of a certain image and a certain lifestyle is lucrative for those people. I mean, it's clear that people make
lucrative, but does it actually convert for the brands?
No. I mean, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, but there's like a tipping point on Instagram. No one sent me anything. No one was interested in sending me anything or whatever. And then we just reached a tipping point. I'd like be sat at an event with somebody who just had the kitchen paid for or whatever. Like, I mean, like £20,000-£30,000 kitchen. And I'm sat there at the other end of the settee and someone had just sent me some gel-cooled pants. They keep your testicles cool. So if you're struggling with infertility, that'll keep your bollocks cool. So I was getting quite different offers. I do sometimes think that if I just reined the entire thing in, I wouldn't have to pay for my own kitchen, which would be quite nice. What's the point in the entire thing? Why would you have started? Why would you ever, you know, why was anybody ever interested in reading the crap that you dished out in the first place? And I think it goes back to what I was saying, how things become so beige. It's great. I'm glad you make an awful lot of money, but is it interesting? And a lot of the time, it just didn't, you know.
I want to go back to, obviously, you've published two books now, and you were in a position where an agent actually approached you, but what would your advice be to someone in the audience or someone listening to the podcast about being able to write a book? Is getting an agent important? Like, what's the process? And also, do you find it, in a world that is so instant, difficult to hold back what you're writing and not share in real time?
In terms of an agent, I think it's really important. At the end of the day, if I'd have gone straight to a publisher's, then they would have essentially given me some sort of advance. I didn't really know how the entire thing worked. These agents got in touch. The first thing I did was join Society of Authors so that I could phone them and say, are these con men? Are these real? Because at the time I was thinking, this must be some sort of catch here. And it's the only way I could find out how the process worked. My agent's absolutely brilliant at going in and getting people. The more people you have interested, the more likely you are to, one, end up with the editor and the publisher that you want, but two, not to be crass, but you end up with more money.
So normally does it work with, so you get an advance, which is what, like 50%, and then royalties?
Yeah,
revenue,
so you'll get an advance. So mine's a two-book deal. You get an advance, and then you earn out that advance in book sales, and once you've earned out that advance, then you receive royalties after that on each book sold. Whereas, how on earth would I go in and negotiate that with a publisher? I didn't have the faintest idea how it worked. But the great thing about my agent is that once he'd got that, he took it to a publisher, and once that publisher was interested, if it was me in that office, I'd have signed there and I'd have given my soul at that point just to get a book deal through. But he just came back and said, no, if they're interested, someone else will be interested. And then slowly set up a bidding war on the first one, and it just went up and up and up. And in the end, I'd like six different publishers to choose from. So
it's better than J.K. Rowling. She got rejected by like 30.
Oh, yeah, I'd have money and sales. And that's why I think an agent's important, because they steer you so well through the entire process. But if you don't know what you're doing, I mean, I'm sure there's people who know publishing a hell of a lot better than I do, who could probably do it themselves in a way.
Do you have management as well as an agent, or does your agent approach you about the book, but for sort of branded campaigns, do you have a talent manager?
I've always sort of avoided it a little bit, just because I turn down so much more than I take that I feel it, I just piss them off. They'd be constantly, oh, I've got you this, and I'd be like, no, not bothered. Not bothered, but you know what I mean? It's just, it has to sort of fit into what I'm doing at the time. It has to fit into the writing. It has to fit into like editing. It has to fit into all kinds of things. Sometimes I just happen to be really enjoying posting about other things, and I don't really want to do that, really. So I've sort of avoided management like that. But through my book agent, they'll get stuff through. And then I have a TV and film agent, they get stuff through. But mostly it comes just directly to me. I quite like that, because I can be as open and honest as I can, and they can say, look, there's never going to be a circumstance in which I'm going to be bothered about that, or give us a shout in 3 months or whatever, like, and we'll have a chat about it then. So
my final question is, what are your predictions for the influencer industry over the next year or two? What do you think we're going to see?
Everybody in a blind panic about losing the likes. Everybody's going to be terrified about that. It'll be fine. Everybody will have forgotten about it in a year. I do think that there's going to be this return to traditional blogging. Everybody's thinking the exact opposite. Everybody's, because, I mean, I neglect my blog something terrible. I don't think I'll put anything on there in like 8 months or something. I basically just have feeds that drag it from Instagram and Facebook, and that's how it updates. And obviously there's been a massive neglect of people's standalone blogs. But I just think there's going to be a reversal of that. I think at the end of the day, that's going to be one platform that is not the whim of algorithms, and it's not the whim of people changing, all that sort of stuff. If you've got followers there, then you control, you know, to a degree what they see far better than somebody sat in Facebook HQ or whatever. So I think there'll be a bit of a return to that. I sort of hope there is.
A big thanks to Matt for coming on the show. You've been listening to Blogosphere, Serious Influence, with me, Alice Audley. Join us next week for a brand new episode. Until then, be sure to check out blogosphere.magazine.com for more influencer industry updates. And why not invest in a subscription to our essential magazine whilst you're there?